My name is Victor Kubik, President of the United Church of God. Welcome to another episode of the Inside United podcast. He was the site manager of the camp at Orr, Minnesota, Floyd Kilcheski and his wife, Mardell. Now with me today is Floyd Kilcheski and his wife, Mardell, along with their oldest daughter, Marlette Kilcheski. And she will tell a story that I feel that you will really, really enjoy. So first of all, I'd like to say hello, Marlette. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here. My name's Marlette Kilcheski, and again, as you stated, I'm the oldest daughter of Floyd and Mardell. So I'm happy to be here and share their story.
She has done more than just talking to us about her story. She has been very instrumental in writing a book about the life of Floyd Kilcheski that we have gotten. It's available on Amazon. The book is entitled Wilderness Son, and my wife and I had it and read many of the stories there, many of which are about bears. So we were saying that we have many stories to tell, but we wanted to focus on people.
Yes.
So, Marlette, I would like to have you tell us a little bit about your mom and dad's background, how Floyd and Mardell became part of our lives.
Yes, I'm happy to share that story with you. I know that mom and dad and myself, my sister Sherry, and my sister Pauline, all came to camp in 1965. We initially were asked to come there by Garner Ted Armstrong because dad was going to map out the canoe routes for the camp. And after the end of the summer, of course, he did everything else, including map out canoe routes. But they also, constructed dorms, dug ditches, put in sewers. And so at the end of the summer, Dr. Lochner asked him to become the site manager. And dad, although he had a very lucrative living in Northern Ontario as a trapper and a guide and a fisherman, he actually was in outdoor life in December of 1965. There's an article called Holiday Moose Hunt. And there were many, many people that contacted him then and asked him, would he, you know, take them out and guide them, either bear hunting, moose hunting, deer hunting, fishing. But he really felt strongly that he wanted to come to camp and serve the brethren. So that is why he made the decision for our family that we were going to leave Northern Ontario and move to Northern Minnesota. So,
well, that's the thing that's fascinated me, because I didn't realize that he was Canadian and that he'd come to the States. Maybe start with that a little bit, because that was very interesting.
Certainly. So my dad was born in Northern Ontario. He was actually born at home. His dad delivered him, and he was the third child of nine children. He was the third boy that they had, and he grew up in the woods and in the bush, and they lived off the land. So he never had a formal education because they hunted and trapped and fished and just made do with whatever work they could find up there in the woods. And then was the summer of 1956, he went to Namekan Narrows Lodge, which is one of the resorts on the American side of one of the border lakes between Northern Ontario and Northern Minnesota. And he met my mother, who was a cabin girl and a waitress from Northern Minnesota. So at the end of the summer, they got engaged, and that was 1956. And in September 7th, 1957, they got married. And they lived in Canada for 9 years. And dad continued to trap, hunt, fish, and guide. But then over time, his father actually had been listening to Herbert W. Armstrong on the radio. And back in the day, remember, they had those very powerful radio stations. So he could get one out of Little Rock, Arkansas. And he listened to Herbert W. Armstrong. Well, his family never had a formal religion. They never went to church. But they had an interest in what Mr. Armstrong had to say. So when dad and mom married, then dad introduced this whole different, you know, concept. And they started listening to Herbert W. Armstrong and the Radio Church of God. And mother did some more research because she was a good Northern Minnesota Lutheran, and she wasn't going to, you know, just easily be converted to a different religion. So she did some research and she decided, you know what? You're right. What was really interesting was she said, Floyd, do you realize you're supposed to be tithing? And dad says, what? Tithing! So I think they grew together in their faith. And they eventually wrote to the church, and they had Mr. Frank McCready, Mr. David Elbert, came up and baptized Mom and Dad on July 11th, 1962, at 9 in the morning on the beach there at Namekan Narrows Resort. And so they continued on, you know, with their lifestyle. But we went to the feast in 1963 because 1962 was too short a notice for them to have been tithing and to have enough money to go to the feast. So we went to the feast in 1963. We took a train down to Dallas, Texas, and then we got some people in the church to give us a ride over to Big Sandy, and we stayed in Tent City. And we did that for several years until we got to the point where we moved to the United States. But what happened is, along the way, Garner Ted Armstrong had heard about Dad and heard about his, you know, guiding skills and his wilderness survival skills. So he got Scott W. Erickson Jr., who was also in the church, and that was like the nearest family in the church. They were from Orr, Minnesota, to get him in touch with Dad. And he came up, and he went fishing for a day with Dad. And at the end of the day, then he asked Dad to come to camp and map out the canoe routes, and that's when Dad said yes, and then kind of the rest is history. And then, of course, when Dad came to camp, and then when we continued to stay there, they really weren't prepared for us to stay there. They invited us to stay. They put Dad on the payroll, but we literally took one of the faculty units and we punched out the wall in between, and we insulated it, and we made that a house for the first couple of years until they built those four homes: one for Garner Ted Armstrong, one for Guy Carnes, one for Dr. Lochner, and then one for the Kilcheskis.
And I do remember that Kilcheski home because we were invited into that home many times, and what we enjoyed most was all getting together to talk and have Mardell tell stories.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So the storytelling is from a long line of storytellers, and that's kind of how the book came to be as well, is Dad always would tell these really interesting adventures of, you know, near-death experiences in the wilderness, and I just asked him to talk to the recorder and, you know, tell the story so that I could just type them up and we'd have them for posterity. There was really no intent to write a book, actually, when it started. So 7.5 tapes later, he sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher, and I had to then have him retell those stories to me physically, like we're doing it now, mm-hmm. so that I could more clearly understand him. That's how that book got written, is basically it's a collection of all of his adventures, and then we just put them together in chronological order, added some photos, and you have a book.
Well, one thing about the camp is that it was property that was acquired
by the church, and it was sold by Scott W. Erickson Sr. So Scott W. Erickson Jr. was in the church. His dad was not, but he sold that property to the church, and the church at the time was looking for property in many different areas of the country, but they chose northern Minnesota. And believe it or not, Scott W. Erickson Sr. almost gave that property away. Basically, he didn't really... he did not charge the church what it was actually worth. So it was a real blessing for the church to be able to acquire that land for the price that we acquired it for.
And that land became kind of a symbol of the development of our youth in the country.
Yes.
Development of youth and also the development of leadership in the ministry, because that was a big part of things. I mean, I've gone up to camp to teach Christian living, you know, and I know that it was something that was a part of so many of us, and I think you had mentioned to me yesterday that camp was instrumental in affecting 60,000 youths in its history.
Yes.
Unique visitors or unique youth?
Unique youth that came to camp. There were 60,000 of them in 35 years. Of course, there were many people that returned year after year after year. I will say that I think one of the things that made that camp so successful was the fact that it was so well organized. And of course, there were so many people who volunteered their time, and it was so well organized. We had some really educated individuals that came up from all of the colleges and that worked as instructors, you know, during the year. And then in the summer, they'd be the head of the canoe department or the basketball department or the volleyball department. And the church actually, of course, invested in some special instructors like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that came up and taught basketball camp.
Wow.
So I think the fact that we were so well organized, we're so quality. I mean, in my opinion, I don't know that you could have a camp that had that much level of quality and organization and structure just all wrapped together. And it's such a very nice package and such a great experience for so many people.
Well, I know that so many people, I can only speak for people that I knew in the Twin Cities, you know, had their children go to camp, and the camp sessions at first were quite lengthy. They were 3 weeks, maybe longer.
They were 3 weeks long. I think that was very long for a young person, maybe 12, 13, 14 years old. Might be kind of challenging to be away from home for 3 weeks. And remember, we didn't have cell phones then. You didn't call home. You might write a letter. You might get a postcard. You might get care packages. That was a big deal, care packages, because otherwise you were subject to eating whatever the dining hall served, which most of the time was good. But I think that was a real challenging time for the younger people. 16, 17, 18 probably enjoyed that independence and being gone for 3 weeks. I think it was just a better length of stay for the general population to do it for 2 weeks. But I think the real challenge was that you had 2 weeks of these individuals being there, very structured classes. We only had 24 hours to turn that camp over for the next session of 500 people for another 2 weeks. So that would mean like staying up all night washing sheets and blankets and towels and getting everything reset for another group of students.
Well, that wasn't all, because after the camp sessions, they allowed us in the Twin Cities to have a Labor Day weekend up there, where they said, you can, because you've done so much to help out with the camp, you bring all your people up here, and we had extra session. In fact, that's where I met my wife. That's a long story, but that's
another. That's so nice.
I didn't really meet her, but I got to know her real well. But again, that's another story. This might be edited out. But we had, I know the camp was instrumental in the lives of so many people. And then when I worked in church administration in Pasadena, I'd go up there every summer to be part of camp for a week or more. And I did teach Christian living and maybe some other things I really can't remember, but I know that it was a very exciting thing to be up there. Since it was my home state, I just felt proud of Minnesota being so instrumental in a nationwide camp. I know that the camp at Orr, Christian living and some of the other things that were taught and how they, even the development of what's called the zone, it really had its origins in Orr, Minnesota, and really had a lot to do with our camp program now, which is only 1 week long. I think the longest of our camps really go is a week, but they really had their genesis, their roots in the camp at Orr.
I do believe that is true. I think, again, the camp at Orr evolved over time. So, you know, we did clothes on a scrub board in the early years, and you literally took your clothes out, your jeans, you were scrubbing them on a scrub board, and then you were going outside to a hand wringer and wringing them out and then hanging them up on the lines. And then over time that evolved into where we had an actual laundromat, we had a laundry department, we did the kids' clothes for them once a week, we did the staff's clothes for them, we did all the clothes for the campers when they came in, we did all the linens, you know. So everything evolved over time and became more and more finite, and I'm going to say just better run, because you had 35 years to kind of get it right. And so I think you're right that you took all of the best pieces, all the best practices are now being used in other camps.
Why do you think the camp at Orr was so successful?
Well, first of all, I think you had the right spirit there to start with. And then you had individuals that were so willing to serve. And I think my parents really embodied that. Both my mom and dad were so willing to serve. It wasn't a 9-to-5 job at all. It was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whenever you needed them, whatever they needed to do. And I think there were many people like them that served up there who had that same attitude and that same desire to really make it the best run place that it could be, that they were always looking to improve, always looking to evolve, always looking to make things the best they could possibly be. And I think then again, you had the right spirit with the children or the students that showed up. And I think we had the right amount of accountability. So if individuals were not behaving appropriately, we did not have any compunction about sending them home. We just excused them. And you know what? That set the tone. That set the expectation of what we expected out of everyone, not just the students, but, you know, the staff and the heads of departments as well. So I think that's why it was so successful.
I know that there were a number of people that were directors of the camp, and you know, as time went by, the one person that I probably had most warm relationship with or working relationship with, Dr. Kermit Nelson.
Yes, Dr. Nelson, I think, really was a fine director because he had a fine mixture of wanting things to be the best they could be, but he also was very open to new ideas, open to improvement, open to continuous improvement. And he was, you're right, he was a people person. So maybe he wasn't as stringent as some of the prior directors might have been. You know, they just had a different, like, let's call it management style, where they were more focused on everything being very structured and very organized and everybody being behaving very appropriately, and not that they shouldn't, but I think Kermit Nelson had a better balance.
I know that when camp started, he had an orientation day, you know, where everybody came to the gym and sat in the bleachers, and all the campers, and he had an orientation that was really just cracked me up because it was just talking about skills and just getting along and being kind to, you know, boys to the girls, and explained the Berlin Wall, they explained it in a way that, you know, people were just very, very warm towards these things that somebody with a strict way could just lay down the law and people be frightened, but they felt very endeared by Dr. Nelson.
I think so. I think he was just, he was actually a very entertaining man. And remember, he also was the individual that instituted, I think it was Friday night donut night. And Patton's Cafe, which was a local cafe, and they were famous for their home of the donut, right? And they would bring hundreds of fresh donuts out on Friday night, and the kids loved it, right? And then remember when we had KSEP, so it was a radio station that really just was for the camp area. And Dr. Nelson would say some interesting things that people would then interject, and it make it really humorous. So one of the things he'd always say is, want a banana? So out of nowhere, you'd get this inserted into the KSEP dialogue and be like, you want a banana?
Well, I think there was one more famous thing than that. This is just my opinion. He had these snow cones or ice cream cones or frozen yogurt cones that he would give. And I remember bringing that machine up from Minneapolis to camp. And he would have it as a reward. You know, he would ask students something, and then he would publicly announce, and you get a free
frozen yogurt.
Free frozen yogurt. I mean, that was his hallmark.
Yes, he did. He did make things fun. And he had, remember, he always had challenges. He'd have a chess challenge. He had the woodchop challenge, where Dad went up against eight students. So Dad was splitting a cord of wood, and eight students were splitting a cord of wood. And of course, the eight students didn't have any experience splitting wood. So they were hacking up the place, and wood's going all over, and Dad's bang, bang, bang. And so they did that little video with Chariots of Fire, right? The theme song to Chariots of Fire, and Dad's in slow motion.
I remember that so well, because I remember that, you know, these strapping students, you know, they thought they were so strong and powerful, be wielding this axe, and it would just hardly dent the wood. And your dad was going to walk up almost twirling the axe, you know, would yield it on the stump, and it would shatter like glass.
Yes, exactly. And then he's like standing there. He's done with this cord of wood. There's still like wood's flying everywhere. Nothing's being split. And he's kind of looking at him like, need some help?
he did it in a very humorous way. You know, your dad, while he did manager things, he was part of the whole culture of the camp.
He was. And, you know, what I admire about my dad is the fact that he took on so many different types of activities that he had absolutely no experience with. And he did it enthusiastically, and he actually became pretty good at some of them. So, you know, he'd never played baseball in his life. He'd never played cricket or croquet in his life. And he'd get out there and he'd give it a whirl. He even went over the water ski jump three times, nearly killed himself. The whole camp turned out because Floyd Kilcheski was going to attempt to go over the water ski jump. So everybody got on Dorm 2 Hill to watch Dad the first time, you know, just like, it was a yard sale. Skis and Dad and the rope and the boats, they're all over the place. The second time he actually made it over, but then there was a big crash at the landing. And the third time he did make it over, his bottom kind of touched a little bit, but he actually made it over. And this was all over a bet. If Dad could make it over the water ski jump, then they'd take our family to Nelson's Resort on Thursday night for smorgasbord dinner.
And he made it.
And he made it.
Well, one thing that we liked, and especially my wife, you know, I'm not a fisherman. Not that I don't like fishing. I just haven't had that much experience with it. But Bev has in her life. She's had fishing experiences. But your dad, always to visitors who came up to camp, you know, from especially from Pasadena, he always offered to take them up to Canada, you know, up to go fishing. But it was more than that. It was not only fishing, you know, for walleye and for northerns, you know, that we had up there, but it's also to cook them, you know, there. You know, he cooked the meal. On the shore, right? And then also he would take us down these rapids that only about one or two human beings on this planet could go down these rapids.
Exactly
but he would take, you know, vulnerable people like us, you know.
Yes.
And people say, you took it down those rapids, and he just was there at the bow of the boat, you know, or the stern, and you know, rode us down the rapids and just safely.
It was such an adventure. You know, he did it because he'd done it for hundreds of times, and he knew exactly where all the rocks were and where the haystacks were and how the different levels of water, depending on the year and the rain amount, where to go and how to make, you know, it completely safe. But it was really very dangerous. I mean, you're right, there was like two people on the face of the earth could run hay rapids. Now there's only one, and that's Dad. And you're right about that. It was always a big adventure because you went up the whole set of the river through Lady Rapids, then Hay Rapids, and then at the bottom of High Falls there, that's where you could, you know, fill up on bass, walleye, and northern pike. And then Dad would flay them right there on a paddle. Watched him do it. He'd get a paddle out and he'd flay them, and then he'd build an open fire and he'd have his potatoes in his sack and he'd make cowboy coffee in a can. And you know, it was a whole adventure. And he, you know, the greatest thing is this. Dad will tell you that his favorite thing that he loved to do in life was guide people. So I think when he came to camp, you know, he gave that up, right? He gave up the guiding, which was his favorite thing to do in life. And people really love to do things that they're good at, right? So he loved to do it because he was very good at guiding and fishing. And so by being able to take people from camp up and give them that experience, he's really doing what he really loved. And I think that was the best part. Everybody won, right? Dad won, the people who went with him won, and it was such a really fantastic experience for everyone.
What do you think that we can say that we have gained from the experience at camp and what it really gave to them as they have come to retirement and have reflected on a number of things? I feel like you probably can tell that better than anyone else.
I think I can because, you know, I've lived it, right? For my father, what he gained was the fact that he got so much of that formal education that had been denied him as a child. And he will tell you, he went to Spokesman Club 3 times. He completed it 3 times. I don't know a lot of people who've been through Spokesman Club 3 times, but it helped him be a better communicator. You know, it helped him he's able to read, not very fast, but he definitely can read. He can communicate with people. He became a deacon and then a minister, and he was actually able to give a sermon, you know, with a beginning, a middle, an end, and a theme. And all of that would not have occurred if he hadn't come to camp. I also think that what he gave was, obviously, both him and Mom are very serving people, and they really like to help others. And I will say that I think I've seen, especially in my mother, she helps people who don't even ask for help. Sometimes it's almost over the top. I'm like, no, would you just leave those people, you know, to themselves and let them, you know, figure it out? But I think that what they gave was they gave themselves, and they gave a support and assistance in every way that they were able to the individuals that came through camp. And I think people really remembered that and really appreciated it. But I think what they got was a lifetime of friendships. I mean, think about those 60,000 unique individuals that came through camp, and many of them over and over again. So there's probably nowhere in the world. We went to Australia for the feast 2 years ago. There's literally no one in the world that they can't walk into a United Church of God site and they don't know somebody.
Now I'd like to talk a little bit about them right now. It's just been, in a way, Marlette, I could say, a little bittersweet to see them here, you know, in their stage, at their stage in life. You know, your dad is in his upper 80s, and your mom, and, you know, it's quite different from what it was when we knew them at the prime of their life. Like I said, it's just been so wonderful to see them you know, at the seniors' lunch that we had, you know, it was just nice to be with them. But they are older now. Your dad has had, both of them have had some health challenges. How are they now?
So I would say that you're right. Dad's 80, he'll be 89 December 10th, and he had a quadruple bypass 5 years ago, and that really changed a lot for him physically. He no longer traps, you know, he really doesn't do any kind of additional work. And so he understands his limitations, and he's actually been very gracious with them. So the last 2 years, Dad has not taken his boat out. I've just taken him up there, and we've enjoyed the day fishing and whatever. And 3 years ago, I took him up to the cabin, and we spent some time up there. So I think that they're doing actually really well, considering their age and their, let's say, health challenges. My mother is 81, but she's had many multiple seizures, so that has impacted her cognition. But she still obviously really is enthusiastic about life. She still tries to tell the story.
We've noticed that. When you're with her, you know, she really buttonholes you and talks and talks and talks. And we enjoy it because, you know, in the things that she says, you know, we see.
You can get a nugget or two.
Well, it's actually even more than that. you have a whole story, a whole chapter, which just endears us to them.
Right. So I will say that all of us girls, because they had five girls, we all live in Minnesota now, and many of us live close to them. They actually live across the lawn from my sister Sherry and my brother-in-law Glenn. So we all step in and support them. In our way, in whatever our ability is. So my sister Pauline is an RN, and her daughter is a doctor, and her son-in-law is a physician as well. So, you know, they're very involved in the medical side of it. And then I'm really involved in what I call the social side of it. I think it's really important to remain engaged as long as you can in whatever ability you have. So I do try to make sure that they get out, like I said, you know, hey, we got them here to Panama City Beach, and we flew on two airplanes, and we managed.
Well, Marlette, one thing I really appreciate about you is that you've been the archivist, you know, to be able to document some of the history, and so I'm glad that we were able to grab you here, you know, and bring you here and be able to talk to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. I'm so glad that I'm able to speak on behalf of my parents. And yeah, they did make a huge contribution to the camp, but they also gained so much along the way, like I said, in experiences and in friends. And now that they're older, they're still really, they so enjoy. We went to the pool today, and they ran into somebody who'd been at camp in 85 and 86, and they talked for 45 minutes. So it was great. It was absolutely wonderful.
Now, the book that you have written, is that still available?
Yes, that is still available on Amazon.com, or you could just contact my dad or mom directly as well to get a book. So either way.
Okay, we'll have an email address for this. But I know that we really appreciated getting the book. We thought, did Floyd write this?
The
title of the book is Wilderness Son.
That's correct.
S-O-N. Well, thank you very much for joining us on Inside United. We hope that you've enjoyed this talk with Marlette Kilcheski, the eldest daughter of Floyd and Mardell Kilcheski. We are found on the UCG.org website. Go to the main menu line and click on podcasts. We're also on Spotify. Go to podcasts and search for Inside United. Also, we're available on any number of Apple or Android podcasting apps. Please write to us. We would love to hear from you at podcast@ucg.org. podcast@ucg.org. We'd love to hear from you. We appreciate the audience that we have. Thank you for listening. So have a great week. See you again soon.
This is a production of the United Church of God. For more, visit ucg.org.